The following talk was recorded at Libra Planet 2022, Living Liberation, an annual conference on current issues in ethics, social justice, and technology from the Free Software Foundation. Libra Planet is a live conference, and speakers often use slides and other visual tools to assist their presentation. You can see the videos of these talks at media.libraplanet.org or on the FSF PeerTube channel. Libra Planet speakers do not represent the mission of the Free Software Foundation. We host speakers talking about their uses of free software in different kinds of political and commercial work. The FSF supports their freedom, but does not take a position on any political issues other than those necessary to uphold the principles of free software. Like all the FSF's work on behalf of the freedom of all computer users, Libra Planet is made possible by thousands of individuals. To keep our work going, please consider becoming an associate member via my.fsf.org/join or making a donation at my.fsf.org/donate. You can stay informed by subscribing to our newsletter, The Free Software Supporter, at fsf.org/fss. For more information on Libra Planet, you can visit libraplanet.org/conference.
Hi, welcome to the Neptune Room. This talk is titled Revitalizing Usenet and will be presented by Tristan Miller. Tristan is a research scientist at the Austrian Research Institute for Artificial Intelligence and a member of Usenet's Big 8 Management Board. He co-maintains several free software packages, including the generic preprocessor GPP and GNU's moderation tool Stomp. Today's talk is about Usenet, which is a worldwide online discussion network that was established in 1980, a decade before the World Wide Web. Unlike web forums, control of Usenet is not centralized, but is rather distributed across an open federation of independent service providers. This makes the system transparent, robust, resistant to censorship, and most importantly, respectful of users' digital freedoms. Thank you, Tristan.
Thanks. So, public discourse today is dominated by commercial social media platforms such as Facebook and Twitter, as well as a plethora of smaller walled gardens that individual media companies such as newspapers and magazines provide for the discussion of their published content. Not only do these companies own and operate the discussion venues, they also use this centralized ownership to control, or at least to exert an overwhelming guiding influence on who participates, on what is discussed, and on what viewpoints are expressed. These companies, moreover, ruthlessly exploit their users for commercial gain. But the internet was not always like this. In the 1980s and 1990s, most online conversations took place on Usenet, a worldwide discussion network that was open to everyone and had no centralized structure, ownership, or control. Usenet was largely operated by and in the interests of its users, many of whom were openly hostile to the idea of commercial influence. And far from being an anarchic Wild West, Usenet succeeded in coalescing its millions of diverse users into a functional, thriving online society, united through shared culture, conventions, and values. In this talk, I want to compare and contrast these two models of online discussion and to discuss the developments that led to the free access public good of Usenet being supplanted by privately owned discussion venues. I also want to talk about the consequences of this transformation and what this means for long-form discussion forums of the future. So just so that we can remind ourselves, let's run through how social media works today from the user's perspective. And let me also add a few comments on what's going on behind the scenes from a technical and economic perspective. To participate in a discussion on social media today, you first need to decide on which social media platform you're going to use. While the major general purpose ones today include Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok, though as the latter two are concerned primarily with images and short videos, which are less conducive to protracted discussion, I'll use Facebook as my primary example. So the next thing you need to do, if you haven't already, is to sign up for an account on one of these services. Now, for Facebook, this is a rather simple matter of filling out a short form with your real name, contact details, and birth date, and then reading through and agreeing to a 130-page, 45,000 word legal contract governing your use of the service and signing over many of your rights and freedoms to Facebook. Now, you may think that's an exaggeration, but if you don't believe me, here's a PDF that I produced by copying and pasting all the terms and conditions from the Facebook website into an A4 paper-sized document and increasing the small print up to a 12-point font. And this is going to take quite a while to go through, even if I use my mouse to scroll all the way through the terms and the conditions. So, of course, most users skip the reading through the terms and conditions part, but that doesn't make the contract any less enforceable by Facebook. After creating an account, you can go ahead and log into the system. Now, normally you do this by visiting the platform's web application in your computer's web browser, or through a standalone app that you download and install onto your mobile device. Either way, this interface or client is generally the only officially permitted way of interacting with the social media platform. If you don't use the company's official client, then you can't use the service at all. And because the source code for these apps is not made public, it can be difficult or impossible, even for a technically skilled user, to verify that the app isn't unduly violating your personal privacy or the security of your device. It's also not possible for the user to modify the app to improve or change its functionality. Now, the first time you log into a new account, most social media platforms will encourage you to provide them with a list of your interests, ostensibly so that they can match you with content or discussion areas that you may like. The platform will also expose a search function that you can use for the same purpose by entering keywords. In addition to existing content providers and discussion areas, the platform will automatically create for you your own personal discussion area that you manage yourself, and you can post your own messages to this area, or perhaps allow certain others or the public at large to do so as well. The platform might also allow you to create additional named discussion groups and also to control who can read and post to them. Now, when you post a message to Facebook, what happens is that it gets sent from your device to a central server that is owned and operated by Facebook. And that is where the message remains. There is only one primary persistent copy of the message, and its canonical home is Facebook HQ. Your own device doesn't keep a copy of the message, though you can, of course, visit Facebook at any point in the future to view it, as can any of your friends or members of the public who you have told Facebook have permission to see it also. Now, the fact that Facebook has a virtual monopoly on the storage of this message, combined with the fact that you've signed over many of your rights to it, means that Facebook is generally free to package, modify, and redistribute your message as it sees fit. And most of the time, that means advertising. Facebook analyzes the content of your message, along with the personal information you already provided to the service, in order to determine what sorts of products and services you and the potential readers of this message would be most receptive to buying. So when Facebook displays your messages to other users, or when it decides what other users' messages to display to you, it will intersperse those messages with personally targeted ads from its customers. And note my terminology here. You may be one of Facebook's users, but you are not one of its customers. Facebook's customers are the companies that buy ad space on its service. And it is these customers, not the users, to which Facebook's own interests are beholden. And what this means is that the entire user experience on Facebook is geared not towards fostering productive public discussion and debate, but rather to get you to visit Facebook as often and as long as possible to maximize your exposure to its customers' advertisements. There are a huge number of mechanisms that Facebook uses to achieve this goal, but let me just give three quick examples. First, longer and potentially more thoughtful posts are always truncated after a few lines, with the remainder hidden behind a See More link that needs to be manually activated. What this does is to encourage users to scroll past these longer messages to get to the next bit of content, which more often than not is an ad. And of course, it's only user posts and never ads which get hidden behind these See More links. This truncation behavior also has the effect of encouraging users to write shorter, punchier contributions rather than carefully reasoned arguments. Second, there is the matter of Facebook's choice of what messages to show in your own personal newsfeed. This is never a full chronological list of posts from the people in the groups that you follow, but rather an algorithmically curated selection of what Facebook thinks that you would find the most interesting. Presenting material from a diversity of viewpoints is not a goal of the system. And so the overall effect is to put users into echo chambers where they hear little more but their own opinions and viewpoints reflected back at them. And third, there's the relatively recent phenomenon of stories, a special kind of user post that gets automatically deleted after 24 hours. Facebook goes out of its way to promote these posts on your newsfeed, and its app encourages you to create them yourself. But users themselves were not the driving force behind the creation of the stories feature. Nobody had been clamoring for time-limited self-destructing messages. Rather, the whole point of this feature is to get people into the habit of visiting Facebook at least once per day so as not to miss out on this artificially ephemeral content. And of course, more frequent visits means more eyeballs on the advertisements. So let's compare this to how people conducted online discussions 20 or 30 or even 40 years ago. Now, keep in mind that although the internet has been gradually built up since the late 1960s, what most people think of the internet today is only one very recent part of it, the World Wide Web. The web is the hypertext-based information system upon which today's social media platforms are based. But this system was invented only in 1989, opened up to the public only in 1991, and didn't really take off in a big way until the late 1990s. So how did people meet and talk publicly online before the web became popular, or indeed before it even existed? Well, the simplest answer to this question is Usenet, also known as Network News, Net News, or just News. Usenet is a computerized communication network that was established in 1980 as a means of propagating public announcements and discussions. It quickly attracted a user base in the millions, and by 1984, it was estimated to account for 85% of all network traffic at participating computing sites. These sites included about 1,000 universities, research labs, and companies all around the world. At its peak in the 1990s, Usenet was seeing 20,000 people post 300,000 unique messages per day, which amounted to some 2 gigabytes of new text every day. As you can see here, Usenet's content has a hierarchical structure that somewhat resembles a modern web-based discussion forum. The discussion groups, which are known as news groups, are organized into a tree-like naming system with hundreds of top-level hierarchies. So for example, the comp hierarchy hosts discussions about computing topics, sci is for the sciences, soc for the social sciences, and so on. So each hierarchy is further subdivided until terminating at the actual news groups, which are referred to by the full path from the top level. So for example, there is the news group soc.history.ancient for discussing ancient history. There's soc.history.medieval for medieval history, and so on. Each newsgroup contains articles, which are the individual messages contributed by users. And each article is submitted to one or more newsgroups according to the topic of the article. And any article can be responded to, making chains of messages called threads. Now, aside from the strange naming conventions for newsgroups, none of this should be too surprising or difficult to understand for users of modern day web forums, or maybe even social media platforms. But under the hood, Usenet is quite different from these modern forums. Unlike Facebook, Twitter, and other web-based discussion systems, Usenet has a decentralized network architecture, where the responsibility for gathering, storing, and distributing messages is spread across a vast federation of independently owned and operated servers. When a user posts an article to one Usenet server, it stores that message and also forwards a copy to all of its neighboring servers. And this process repeats itself until the article has been propagated to every server in the entire Usenet network. In the early 1980s, this process could sometimes take several days, but with advances in networking infrastructure, the lag time was gradually reduced to hours and then to minutes, and by today, even seconds. So each server makes the articles it has received available for reading to its own users and will also send out any replies they post to the rest of the Usenet network. Now, a great advantage of this architecture is its resilience, both to failure and to censorship. Because every server in the network receives a copy of every message, the loss of any one server does not result in the loss of any data. If one Usenet server goes down, either temporarily or permanently, then all the messages posted to it generally remain available from any other server on the network. By contrast, when Facebook or Twitter goes down, nobody can read any of the posts there. And if either of those two companies were to go out of business, their entire archives of messages could be irretrievably lost forever. For the same reasons, there is no effective way to censor or delete a posting to Usenet. Once a message has gone out, it persists in thousands of copies all over the world almost instantaneously. Should Facebook or Twitter object to one of your social media posts, however, they can delete it at their pleasure. And unless you kept a separate copy for yourself, it's gone forever. So how did this work from the user's perspective? If you were an ordinary internet user in the 1980s or 1990s, how did you get onto Usenet and start using it? Well, unlike with Facebook and Twitter, there was generally no formal sign-up process. Chances are, whatever internet connection you normally use to get online, whether that was through your school or your employer, or maybe your home dial-up or broadband internet provider, would be running its own Usenet server as part of its normal internet service. But even if they didn't, there were many free public access Usenet servers that you could connect to, and even a few offering paid subscriptions. Terms of service contracts ranged from short to non-existent, and in any event, were not crafted to commodify your messages for the benefit of the service provider. To set up your computer for use with Usenet, you'd need to install something known as a news client or news reader, which operated in much the same way as an email program. Unlike today's Facebook and Twitter, where you're obliged to use the company's official client, there were dozens of news clients to choose from, many of which were available free of charge. Home ISPs often bundled a news reader with the software delivered to new customers, but you could always download and install a different one. Users often tried out several different news readers before settling on one that met their own particular needs and preferences. Many of these news readers also freely released their source code, so if you knew how to program, you could make further adaptations and customizations yourself, and then share these with other users. So upon starting up the newsreader for the first time, you would provide your name or alias, your email address, and the name of your ISP's news server, and, well, that was pretty much it. You were now on Usenet. The newsreader would show you a list of all the available news groups, of which there would be several thousand, and you could select a group from this list to see all of the recent articles posted in it, the same way that you select a folder in an email client. You could then read and reply to an article or start a new thread, and your newsreader would then submit your message to the news server for propagation throughout the entire network. So this whole process seems simple, but consider the implications of this simplicity. With no ulterior motive to get people onto Usenet, that is, with no advertisements, the people involved in Usenet were all working for the singular common goal of fostering public discussion. The programmers of Usenet server software and newsreaders, programmers who were themselves the users of the system, focused on functionality and usability issues that were defined by real-world needs, not the profit motive of a central platform operator. Non-programming users, who had a free choice of newsreaders, gravitated to those that best served their own personal communication needs. Users would have quickly abandoned any newsreader that actively constrained or even sabotage their freedom to discover, read, and contribute information the way that social media platforms are designed to do. And it's clear that the users themselves understood the benefits of Usenet as a medium. So here's how one internet chronicler, Michael Halbin, writing in 1995, described his first experiences with Usenet. One professor's encouragement helped me to use Usenet and the internet as places to conduct research. My research was real participation in the online community by exploring how and why these communication forums functioned. I posed questions on Usenet, mailing lists, and freenets. Along with these questions, I would attach some worthwhile preliminary research. People respected my questions and found the preliminary research helpful. The entire process was one of mutual respect and sharing of research and ideas. A real notion of community and participation takes place. I found that on the net, people willingly help each other and work together to define and address issues important to them. These are often important issues which the conventional media would never cover. And he later wrote, "Easy connection to people and ideas from around the world has a powerful effect. Awareness that we are members of the human species, which spans the entire globe, changes a person's point of view. It is a broadening perspective. It is very easy for people to assume a limited point of view if they are only exposed to certain ideas. The net brings the isolated individual into contact with other people, experiences, and views from the rest of the world. Exposure to many opinions gives the reader a chance to actually consider multiple views before settling on a specific opinion. Having access to the marketplace of ideas allows a person to make a reasoned judgment. Furthermore, users like Halbin understood that these benefits were due in large part to Usenet's decentralized and non-commercial nature. In 1993, Halbin wrote, "The net has only developed because of the hard work and voluntary dedication of many people. It has grown because the net is in control and power of the people at the grassroots level, is in the control of power and the people at the grassroots level, and because these people developed it. People's posts and contributions to the net have been the developing forces. And much of the development of Usenet owes a big thanks to the early restrictions on commercial uses. Where else in our society has the commercial element been so clearly separated from any entity? Forums of discussion and communication become clogged and congested when advertisements use space. Because of the voluntary actions of those who use and redistribute net news and email, people on Usenet feel it is wrong to assist commercial ventures. When people feel someone is abusing the nature of Usenet, they let the offender know through email and in public messages. In this manner, users work to keep Usenet as a forum that is free from commercial exploitation. Usenet is not allowed to be abused as a profit-making venture for any one individual or group. Rather, people fight to keep it a resource that is helpful to society as a whole." So, what happened between then and now? How did we get from the internet of the 1980s and 1990s, where the vast majority of public discourse was conducted on an open, ownerless, freely available discussion network designed and operated by and for its users, to today's world of centrally controlled, profit-driven social media that actively suppresses the transmission and diversification of ideas? And given that many of the millions of people on Usenet had actually foreseen the threats of commercialization and commodification, how and why did they allow it to happen? Unfortunately, this is the point in my talk where I need to depart from factual knowledge and venture into the realm of speculation. I don't really have any firm answer to this question, though there are a couple ideas that we might discuss. So first, we might examine the economic forces at work. In the course of history, capitalism triumphed over earlier forms of production, such as slavery and feudalism, because it was more efficient. It could be that similar material forces shaped the development of discussion technology. Usenet was developed largely by unpaid volunteers or by co-opted university staff and students. And as I've already explained, this means that it was developed to meet these volunteers' own needs. But this also means that the system was improved as and when resources became available, and without any particular targets or deadlines. By contrast, the people that created social media companies, having identified ways in which online communication could be exploited for commercial gain, were able to marshal a significant amount of human and technical resources into the rapid development of new technologies. This development quickly eclipsed the state of community-developed networks, drawing users in with certain new and, in some cases, genuinely useful features, such as support for images and audio-video posts, or better integration with mobile devices, but at the same time adding additional features that were useful only to the platform's customer base of advertisers and market researchers, and even eventually removing or sabotaging the discussion-oriented features that users had come for in the first place. Second, it could be that Usenet's socially conscientious user base was simply swamped by the huge influx of new users who got online for the first time in the late 1990s and early 2000s. Far more so than other parts of the internet, Usenet assimilated its users into a diverse but cohesive community, united through shared culture, shared values, and techno-social conventions. Users coming to Usenet for the first time in the 1980s and 1990s were warmly welcomed into this cooperative and largely commercial-free world. But it always took a bit of time, as well as the concerted efforts of the existing population, to acculturate these newcomers. Now, this wasn't a problem in the early decades of Usenet, before network access became commonplace. But the explosion of home internet connections in the 1990s meant that users started arriving to Usenet faster than the resident netizens could show them what their new cooperative online world was all about. And with no one to guide them, these users came to view the internet as a service rather than as a society, and therefore gravitated to platforms like Facebook that had the best financial and technical means to attract them. So where do we go from here? Will online society ever abandon big social media and return to the more egalitarian, more cooperative, by and for the people model that it enjoyed in decades past? Or are we destined to remain in the thrall of corporations like Facebook and Twitter, allowing them to commodify our personal data and conversations in the name of profit? Well, I think that there are two glimmers of hope. First, in the last few years, we have seen some earnest and increasingly useful efforts, and increasingly successful, I should add, efforts at developing and running new decentralized social media networks that are based on open standards and free software. These include the OStatus and ActivityPub standards for federated provision of notifications and content, as well as microblogging platforms such as GNU Social and Mastodon. In fact, Angel Garcia Menendez gave an excellent talk about these sorts of federated platforms in an earlier session at today's conference. So I won't say too much more about them now, except to say that while it's great that such initiatives exist, they do tend to be Twitter or Facebook knockoffs. And this means that they share some of the same disadvantages as those platforms, and also don't lend themselves well to long-form, fully threaded discussions in the same way that Usenet does. But this actually brings me to my second point, which is Usenet is still around today. And while it isn't as popular as it was in its heyday, its activity does seem to have stabilized, and much of its essential maintenance work is still being carried out by its volunteers. So, if people accustomed to web forums ever push for a return to a decentralized model based on open protocols and free software, Usenet will still be here waiting to receive them, or at least to serve as a slightly rusty but still working model upon which to base a possibly newer system. And what I'd like to do now is to tell you a little bit about my own involvement with Usenet as a member of the Usenet Big 8 Management Board, and the small part that we're doing to help keep the network running smoothly. So to help you better understand this, I want to give just a few more details about how Usenet is organized, starting with the people behind the scenes. Some of the main actors are listed here on this slide. So first, we've got the Internet Engineering Task Force, or IETF, which is responsible for drafting and publishing open standards for Usenet's networking and communications protocols. Developers use these standards to write interoperable software that powers news servers and news clients, as well as associated utilities such as moderation tools and spam filters. Not all of this software is free software, but the packages most commonly used today generally are. Newsmasters, or news server administrators, are responsible for the day-to-day operation of news servers. Some of these are open to the public, some of them operate by subscription only, and some of them are private systems run for the benefit of a particular company, school, or individual. The Internet Systems Consortium, or ISC, maintains a de facto canonical list of moderators and relays for moderated news groups, though individual news servers are free to use a list of their own. And finally, each top-level hierarchy on Usenet may or may not have a managing entity to which its community delegates responsibility for implementing changes to the hierarchy, such as adding or removing groups or notifying the ISC about new moderators. Now, the best-known hierarchy, or rather group of hierarchies, with a managing entity is known as the Big Eight. Now, in a nutshell, these hierarchies contain all of the original public news groups that had been established between Usenet's founding in 1980 and 1987, when they were reorganized into seven top-level hierarchies. They're listed here: Conk, MISC, News, REC, SCI, SOAP, and TALK. And an eighth hierarchy, Humanities, was added in 1995. Now, in the early days of Usenet, there was no established procedure for creating news groups. Groups were created simply by posting to them. Now, as you can imagine, this resulted in a lot of useless groups created unintentionally as the result of typos. The community later developed a process by which someone would first propose a new group, and then that proposal was discussed and voted upon by the community. However, as Usenet and the Big Eight became more and more popular, this system also proved problematic, with procedures becoming difficult to follow or implement due to noise, poor use of subject lines, multiple parallel discussions, and lack of understanding or agreement on the notion of consensus and the purpose of voting. So eventually it was decided, at least in the Big Eight, to establish a committee, the Big Eight Management Board, which was tasked with facilitating community discussions using a more or less standard set of procedures and with assessing the consensus and implementing the decisions arising from those discussions. So this new procedure seems to have worked well for the first 10 years or so of the board's existence, but owing perhaps to the decline in the overall traffic on Usenet, the board gradually wound down its activity and appears to have become moribund around the year 2017. And what this meant was that a number of vital administrative tasks, such as replacing absentee moderators, were left undone. And this is the point at which I stepped in. I noticed that it was no longer possible for me to post to one of my favorite news groups, comp.ai, because the moderator's university had shut down access to his moderation software and he was unable to host it elsewhere. Now, I volunteered to take over as moderator, but since all the board members' terms had long ago expired, there was no one left to respond to my offer. Eventually, in 2020, I and two other long-term Usenet users, Jason Evans and Rainer Lucas, managed to get in touch with the former board members, who agreed to elect us as their successors. So we quickly set to work revamping the board's aging infrastructure and web presence. Within a few months, we had overhauled the board's website and wiki, including a new design and a restructuring of its essential policy documents and archives. And in parallel to this, we took over maintenance of Stump and WebStump, the most popular software packages for maintaining moderated news groups. Both packages are part of the GNU project, but had not seen a new release under the previous maintainer in 20 years. So we fixed a number of bugs and security issues and improved compatibility with modern operating systems. We've even managed to grow the developer community a bit and to apply a number of feature enhancements contributed by some third parties. So we hope to issue a new major release as soon as we've updated the corresponding documentation. In 2021, the board joined Open Collective Europe, which is a fiscal hosting platform that allows us to accept donations and also to record our expenses with complete public financial transparency. So now everybody knows how we get our money and how we spend it. And in addition to all this ancillary and infrastructural work, we've of course resumed the core administrative duties of the board. We've replaced moderators for a number of groups where the old moderators have stepped down or gone missing. We've initiated discussions to remove defunct groups, and we've even overseen the creation of the Big Eight's first new news group since 2013. That group for the new hypertext system Gemini has been flourishing since its creation last October. And finally, we've taken it upon ourselves to serve as public ambassadors and proponents for the Big Eight hierarchy and for Usenet as a whole. We've produced and published a number of tutorials on how to use Usenet. We've given a variety of conference talks on Usenet, including the one you're attending right now. And we've made ourselves available for interviews and Q&A sessions, such as last year's AMA on Reddit. And we do this because we are passionate about Usenet and its open and decentralized nature, and we fervently believe that it still has much to offer the modern day internet user. So that brings me to the end of my talk. To recap, in this presentation, I've introduced, or perhaps to many of you reintroduced, Usenet, a well-established discussion network that predates the web and most social media by some 10 or 20 years. It's built on open standards and runs largely on free software, and it has a decentralized structure. And these features make it robust and resistant to censorship and largely respectful of users' digital freedoms. Despite its age, Usenet is still in active use, and the underlying infrastructure and tools are still being maintained and even now actively developed. All in all, we believe that Usenet has much to offer over today's web-based discussion forums and social media platforms. Usenet is ready for your participation and support. And so on behalf of the entire Big Eight Management Board, we hope to see you all there in the near future. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tristan. Well done. There were sort of discussions in the IRC, some talk about the old days. One question that came up about spam and how that's handled. Is that something that you want to address? Or?
Yeah, spam is a problem on Usenet the same way that it is a problem on almost any social media platform or web forum. And, you know, there are social solutions to it, there are technical solutions to it, and I should also preface this by saying that because Usenet traffic has declined in recent years, it isn't quite the same problem that it used to be. Though then again, a lot of anti-spam measures are now concentrating on things like email and social media. Certainly many of these could be adapted and repurposed to use on Usenet, which would probably be a good thing if Usenet were ever to revive to the extent that that it existed in the late 1990s at the height of its popularity.
There was some other historical discussion about AOL and how it approached Usenet. There's also
I touched on this a bit in the talk when I said that perhaps one of the reasons for the decline of Usenet or its loss of character or mission may have been the influx of users, the huge influx of users in the late 1990s and early 2000s when commercial online internet providers such as AOL introduced gateways to Usenet and basically set their millions of users loose on Usenet without really giving them a chance to acculturate to, you know, sort of what was expected to them, you know, to accepted norms of social behavior on the network. Things that were collectively referred to as netiquette. nowadays, of course, everyone is on the internet. A lot of the original culture does survive, and hopefully users of new users of Usenet can continue to be acculturated now that there is a larger overall population of internet users. You know, perhaps the flow of new users will no longer overwhelm the existing ones.
In that regard, how does a beginner get started with Usenet? What's the best way to join up?
Well, the procedure hasn't really changed much from the old days. Basically, find a Usenet client, find a Usenet server, and start them, enter your name, email address, and the host name of the Usenet server there. If you want to get some tips for getting started for what Usenet client to try and what free Usenet servers exist, there are two places you can look. There are some good articles on Wikipedia, which can help get you started. And there's also our own Usenet Big 8 Management Board website. We're actually currently working on overhauling some of the guides there, but it's one thing you can look at as well. We are trying to get the list of news clients and free news servers up to date. You can always write to us directly as well, board@big8.org.
Is that a good resource for folks that want to contribute and help out?
If they want to help out with the with the duties of the Big 8 Management Board itself, sure, we're always looking for volunteers. So anyone is free to get in touch with us. If you visit our website, in one of the menus on the front page, there should be a prominent link on how to volunteer. If you want to get involved with other aspects of Usenet outside the Big 8, there's no shortage of opportunities. You can, if you're a programmer, you can help write news server or news client code. If you just want to get online and help new users, there are news groups dedicated to answering new users' questions. Again, no shortage of ways that you can contribute if you want to do something more than just use it as a discussion forum.
And when you access it, are you using something like Thunderbird, like a common email client, or do you have a specific Usenet client?
Yeah, at the moment I use Thunderbird, which is free software released under the Mozilla public license, just as a matter of convenience, because I have to use Thunderbird as an email client for work. So it basically cuts down on switching between applications, and I can share my SIG files and other user identities between the two. But don't take that as being a recommendation. That's the only good Usenet client. For people who love Emacs, there are built-in news readers for that. There are plenty of other free software tools. Knode was one that I really loved using in the past, though unfortunately it's no longer maintained. I really hope if someone wants to contribute to Usenet and wants to make me really happy, I'd absolutely love it if someone would start maintaining Knode again.
Okay, we have about 2 or 3 more minutes. Taking a look here, see if there's something else I could bring up.
Well, since people asked about free news servers, I could mention that there's a couple ones that that I think are pretty good. So I think one of them is called AIOE.org, and the other one is Eternal September. So that's eternal-september.org. Both of them will allow you to sign up just by filling in a form or maybe even just connecting directly to the news server. Though if you're a member of a university, there's a good chance that your university still operates a news server of its own. Or if you get online through an ISP, your ISP might still be running a news server, so you can always ask them or check whatever documentation that you were given when you signed up, or check the website of your ISP.
Okay. Okay, well, I guess we're getting very close to the end. I just want to thank you again. A really nice presentation, and thank you for your work on this and bringing it forward. Such a nice time to have other options for online discussion, and hope to see you again down the road.
It was my pleasure. I hope to see you and many others on the news groups.
Sounds great.
Goodbye.
Bye.